As we begin this morning, I want you to think of a taxi driver. Perhaps this taxi driver is a Muslim, a devout Muslim, who would be then a fatalist. That is, he believes that whatever Allah wills will happen. And so as he picks up his passenger to take him along, he says, "If Allah has willed for me to get this passenger safely to his destination, it will happen. If he has willed that he not get to that destination safely, then that will also happen. And so it makes no difference what I do. I can go careening through the streets and I can go as fast as I want so that I can get another passenger and perhaps make more money that way." And so that's the attitude of the fatalist. Now think of another taxi driver. This taxi driver thinks of himself as a good person. He's good to his wife and family. He provides for them. He cares for them. He even worships the Lord. He goes to his church on the Lord's Day and joins with God's people to worship the Lord. And he thinks of the Lord as a loving God. But he has also noticed that there are some things that happen in his life that are unpleasant. And so he has come to the conclusion, as have many in this situation, he has come to the conclusion that God just is not able to do everything that we want him to do. He's not able to preserve us. And so he does not have a God who is all powerful, because he thinks of himself as good. He thinks of God as loving. And when you put those two things together, you have to conclude that when there are bad things that happen, he must not be able to do everything that he would like to do. And so let's think then, let's continue with him for a moment. As he takes his passenger from one place to another, he is going to be very careful in the way that he drives, knowing that the first driver and others like him are on the streets. But he thinks that everything is up to him, and he is worried because of all these other drivers that are not so careful. Now let's go to a third one. Somewhat like the first taxi driver, he believes that God is sovereign. He believes that God is able to do whatever he chooses to do. That he has declared the end from the beginning. But also, like the second driver, he believes that he has a responsibility in taking his passenger to his destination to get him there safely. Here we have three different attitudes, you see, toward the world and the way that God deals with us in the world. Is he one that has just said, this is what's going to happen, and so the world is set in motion and it just carries itself out? Or is God one who is loving and so interacts with us but just isn't able to do whatever he chooses to do? Or is it like the third person who says, yes, God has determined all things from the beginning. He even declared that Jesus would be killed and that he would rise again the third day. But also that we are responsible. We are responsible to do what God has told us to do. As we think of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we think of the fact that those who killed him were responsible for his death. And they could not, like that first taxi driver, say, well, whatever I do, it makes no difference. There's a poem that I recall where the man says, "It makes no difference whether I've done, if I do bad, it's not my fault. And if I do good, I don't have any reason to boast." And so he looks at life fatalistically. Actually, in this particular poem, he is mocking what he thinks is predestination. The Apostle Paul is like that third person. And we're going to be looking at Acts chapter 27, where Paul is out on the sea, remembering the storm as we've been studying through the book of Acts. And he's out in the storm with many others with him. And in the midst of that storm, he remembers God, and he knows that God is there. But many others, nearly everybody else on this boat, on this ship, has lost all hope of being saved. We take up our reading then in the middle of the storm, beginning with Acts chapter 27, verse 21, and we'll read on through the end of the chapter. And I want you to notice particularly what it is that the angel says to Paul and how Paul reacts as with that information from the angel of the Lord. Acts chapter 27, beginning with verse 21. After the man had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.' On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea when, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. They took some soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings and again and found it 90 feet deep. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved.' So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. 'For the last 14 days, he said, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head.' After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land in safety." May God bless to us the reading of this portion of His Word and instruct us from it as we consider together this matter of the care of God and the way that He cares for us. It's hard to imagine what it must have been like for Paul to have that angel suddenly appear to him. How would you react? How do you think that you might react if an angel suddenly stood before you? The first words that Paul tells us regarding this angel saying to him were, "Don't be afraid." And you can understand at the very beginning why he might say, "Don't be afraid." After all, if this suddenly happens, wouldn't there be fear in your heart? Not knowing why or how this had suddenly come about that this angel stood before him. But it seems that there is much more of a reason than that for him to say, "Don't be afraid." You see, you need to remember what God had told Paul way back at the time that he was still in Caesarea. He was being held captive. And how God had informed Paul very clearly that he would stand trial in Rome, that he would get to testify of God and His grace there in Rome, to tell them of the resurrection of Jesus Christ for our salvation. When you find God saying something like this to His people, or an angel speaking to the people, one who has been sent to speak to someone, it's often said, "Don't be afraid," not because I'm suddenly here and you're scared of me, but because here is something that God has promised to His people and He is about to carry it out. That's the reason for him to say, "Don't be afraid." It would be easy to lose heart as you see all these things happening around you that would seem to prevent the will of God from being accomplished. "Don't be afraid. The will of God will be accomplished," is what he is saying to Paul here. "Don't be afraid. You must stand trial before Caesar." A similar case that you might think of is when the birth of Jesus is foretold to his mother. We read that the angel Gabriel came to Nazareth in a town of Galilee to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph. The angel went to her and said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored of the Lord is with you. Do not be afraid, Mary. You have found favor with God. You will be with child and give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. His kingdom will never end." If he were to say, "Don't be afraid, Mary," because his very presence would scare her, that would have been the first thing that he said, wouldn't it? But he's saying, "Don't be afraid. There's something that you've been looking for. And it's about to happen now. Don't be afraid that it won't happen. God is carrying out his purpose. And he's using you to do it." That was the message he was giving to Mary. And so it is that he says to Paul as well, "Don't be afraid, you will stand trial before Caesar." Because that's what Paul wanted to do. He wanted to go to Rome. He wanted to testify of Jesus there. And he saw all of this in the providential working of God to bring him to Rome to fulfill that duty. God says to us, "Don't be afraid." He has determined his work. He has determined to do his good work, and he will do it. Even as Paul wrote to the church in Rome, that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him, to those who are the called according to his purpose. And so it is that the true God keeps you in spite of the fears that rise around you. Think of the fears that Paul might have had at this time. First of all, there was the storm. The first day of the storm would have been enough to make anyone afraid, thinking that they might lose their lives the way they were being driven. But instead of that happening, God provides for them and protects them, not just the first day, but the second day and the third day, on through the first week and on into the second week. And this lasts for 2 weeks, and God has preserved them. If you read this for the first time and are anticipating Paul being taken to Rome to testify of God there, you begin to see this as a bit of a thriller. How's Paul going to get there? How can he get there through that storm? But then there's more than that. Nobody is eating food. Nobody wants to eat. Perhaps most of them are seasick. We're not sure. But they're scared. How will anybody have the strength to continue sailing the ship properly and directing it? How will they be able to get to shore once they get to that place where, in this case, they had to swim or to surf using the parts of the ship? And then they're concerned about the rocks that they might run aground on. And that might be a long ways from land, so that even if they have to swim to shore, will they be able to swim that far? Will there be land close enough? And so they were concerned about the rocks that they might run aground on. And then there are those sailors who know how to run the ship. And they try to escape. And yet God keeps them there as he uses Paul to do something that we might not expect him to say when he has already been told by God and has been assured by him that he will stand trial in Rome. He will get to go and testify of God there, because he says, He says to the centurion, if you allow these men to escape, we cannot be saved. That almost sounds contrary, doesn't it, to what the angel had already told him, the assurance that he had given him. But you see, Paul was recognizing the responsibility that they had in order to work within the providence of God to see that his will would be accomplished. And so it was that the ropes were cut so that the little boat that they might go ashore in would be set loose, and the sailors would remain on the ship. Well, now there's another danger. Okay? As long as there are these prisoners that are being taken to Caesarea to Rome, if we allow them to get into the water by themselves, to swim by themselves, they can get away. And as a soldier, it's my neck if they get away. It's not going to be my neck, it's going to be his. And so they make ready to kill all of these prisoners, including Paul. But Paul, by this time, has built up such a reputation with the centurion that he does not allow the soldiers to take the lives of these prisoners. And then there's the danger of the sea itself as they swim to shore. Yet, you see, God is in all of this. The trials even are part of his providence, as well as the joys, in order that we might be drawn to him. He is able because he is all powerful. So you see, God has determined to do you good in His grace. He works all things together for the good of those who love Him. But now, something else that He does is that for you who love Him, He blesses the world through you. Note particularly what Paul was told by the angel. Paul says that the angel said to him, "Don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you." Why didn't the angel just say, "Now look, Paul, you're going to be safe. And everybody else on the ship is going to be safe too." But he says it in a very different way. He says, "Paul, God has given you the lives of all these people on the ship with you." Why does he say it that way? It's because God gives others to you. He makes you to be a blessing to those around you as you have a responsibility toward them to bring them to the throne of grace. Now, there's something that Luke does not tell us here that we have to assume, and you know that Paul was a man of prayer. It's very evident that Paul has been praying not only that he would be brought safely through this, but that God would spare the rest of the people on the ship as well. Now, that's not mentioned in the text, but that's the pattern that we find in other places of Scripture. You see, you are watchmen who are not to remain silent. In Isaiah 62, verses 6 and 7, we are reminded that we are watchmen who are not to remain silent, but who are to be calling upon God, not giving Him rest. And we do that so that He would build up Jerusalem, so that He would build up His people. He would establish His own purpose. Through you, God blesses those around you. God has put people who are in the world in your care, in our care as the church, as God's people. Think of the ways that Paul was able to be a blessing to the people here on the ship. First of all, God revealed His will to them, for them through Paul. And while we don't anticipate an angel coming and standing next to us to tell us about some event or something that's going to happen, nevertheless, we have the revelation of God, which shows us the will of God for His people, which we are able to tell to others. The Scriptures have given that to us. And so Paul was a blessing to them in that way, in being one who was able to communicate the will of God to these people. Another way is that he gave them encouragement. Remember, back in the 20th verse, it says that they had lost all hope. And then we are told that no one was eating. After all, they're thinking, "I'm going to die." They're not anticipating being able to make it through, and eating was the last thing on their minds. Paul is able to encourage them to give thanks, to break bread and begin to eat it himself. And so it was that the others were encouraged, and they also began to eat. It's also through you that you begin, that others who are with you come to enjoy the favor of God. I want you to think back to Genesis chapter 18, where God comes down to meet with Abraham. His nephew Lot has moved all the way to Sodom. And God had seen the wickedness of Sodom, and he's come to destroy it. And Abraham, and he tells Abraham that that's what he's, what's to happen. And Abraham thinks of his nephew, Lot, and his wife, and his daughters who are there. And his daughters are engaged to be married. He said, Lord, if you find 50 people righteous in that city, won't you spare it? He said, I'll spare it if I find 50 righteous there. And Abraham says, what if you're missing five? What if there's only 45? God says, I'll spare it if there are 45 there. And Abraham goes and works it all the way down to 10. If I find 10 righteous ones in Sodom, I will spare it. You see, God was really saying to Abraham that because of the righteousness of these who loved him, he would spare those around him. There is a blessing that the people of God bring to the nation. There's a blessing that the people of God bring to the town. We, as a congregation of God's people, should be a blessing to Ridgefield Park, New Jersey. There is a blessing that they should have, but that means that we also need to take the responsibility toward the town to be praying for the town, to be longing for this town to know God. And a part of that is another of the blessings that Paul no doubt brought to some of those people. And that, of course, was the message of saving grace. And it's perhaps through these events that some of them were brought to faith. We aren't told that that happened, but it's very possible. We might even say likely that that happened. And so here's Paul, who has been no doubt praying for the people on the ship. And God says, I have graciously given them to you. It's not just that they are somehow spared, but there's a connection that they have to this man of God, so that there is a blessing that he is to them. That's the pattern that we find then with God's people as we look through the rest of Scripture. So God blesses the world through you who love him. And that's who we must be. So then also, thirdly, we are called to serve him as we belong to him. Serve him when you belong to him, because as Paul says, that it was an angel of God whose I am and whom I serve. You see, God fulfills his will as you serve him. He's given you his law so that you may know how to serve him. He has told you to draw near to him. And it's in your obedience that he brings about his will. He accomplishes his purpose. So that it's not for you to say, okay, God has said this is what he's going to do. He's going to save whom he's going to save. He's going to bless whom he's going to bless. But there's a responsibility, like the taxi driver, to say, I have a responsibility towards this passenger to get him there safely. Even though God has determined whether that will happen or not. But I'm able to rest comfortably in him because he accomplishes his purpose. And I am with him. I am in him. And so there is nothing to fear. Do not be afraid. God is carrying out his purpose. I remember a young man saying to me, he was a fellow who had grown up in the church. And he said to me, well, God saves those whom he saves. And it just hasn't taken with me, so
I'm leaving.
No, that's not the way you are to react. Jesus says, come. Come. He doesn't say, leave it to me and forget about it. Forget about any responsibility. He says, you will seek me and you will find me when you seek for me with all your heart. Have you come? He calls you to come. And I echo that call to you now, that you might come to Jesus Christ, repenting of your sin, to embrace the gospel that he has given, to embrace the grace that he gives to his people. Though he is the one who determines that you are to be saved, yet he calls on you to come and he counts you to be responsible, so that if you do not come, you are guilty. You will have sealed your own condemnation. Don't blame him if you are condemned for eternity. He called you to seek him. And he says, the one who comes to me, I will never cast out. Have you come? If not, I would plead with you to seek him with all your heart, that you would know him who says, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. But also to all of us, call on him to do what he has willed to do. Now that may sound strange, but I submit to you that we do that quite often. That we have a responsibility to pray for what God has said he will do. Think about it. You go to a football game. And your team is out there with the ball and they're running. They've called a play that they want to run. Do you just sit back in the stands and say, well, they're going to run whatever they want to run? No, you say, do it! Run it to the best of your ability, and they cheer them on. God has told us what he will do, and he says to us to cheer him on in it, to call on him to do it. Your friend says to you, I think I'm going to ask her to marry me. Do it! You say to your friend, unless you have some reason to warn him not to do it. But you know that what God has said is good. And it's what you ought to be cheering him on to do. You call on him in prayer. Pray because God is able to do all things. This fatalist fellow that we talked about, the only reason for him to pray is because God told him to pray, and he thinks that that's the way he has his salvation. What about the second taxi driver who doesn't think that God is able to do everything? He prays out of worry. Oh, Lord, I hope you'll do this, but I have no confidence in it because I don't think you're able to do everything. But the one who believes that God is able to do exceeding abundantly beyond all that we ask or think, that he is able to do whatever he chooses to do, is able to pray with confidence and to ask God to do that very thing. Pray, calling on God to do what he has said he would do. Because what he desires to do is good. Our God is omnipotent. He is all wise. He foreordains all things for his glory. Who of us would ever have thought that if we were in charge of the world, we would have the one who would be the champion be one who would die and rise again from the dead. But because he is all powerful, that's what he chose to do. And that's the way our salvation has been won. So that should give you comfort. It should give you confidence as you are driven to him, as he calls you to seek him. Pray. Pray so that his will be accomplished. And so we join the psalmist in Psalm 61, who was praying for the will of God to be accomplished. My voice and prayer, O God, attend. Turn, please, to this in your psalters. My voice and prayer, O God, attend. From ends of earth to thee I send my supplicating cry. When troubles overwhelm my breast, then lead me on the rock to rest that higher is than I. And so he finds his hope, his comfort in the rock, Jesus Christ. Let us praise God.